Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about black marketeering and rationing and stockpiling, hoarding, and speculation in Stalinist Russia before the Second World War. So that period we've been looking at quite a lot, 1928 to 1939. And we're drawing mainly from Sheila Fitzpatrick's brilliant book, Everyday Stalinism. So it was extremely difficult to gain goods of really any kind, from consumer goods through to the basics of life, such as housing and food, using the formal system of acquiring these things through the bureaucratic state and the systems of distribution of resources that the Stalinist state had. It was almost designed to create shortages and surpluses of unused goods. Bureaucracies that distributed them were inefficient, as we know, and extremely corrupt. So the informal system of BLAT, which really is, you know, summarised as who you know, was the way in which most Soviet citizens got round these shortages, if they got round them at all. State-owned shops had huge queues outside, and normally there were at least some empty shelves, if not a majority of them. Waiting lists for housing through local authorities were very, very long. So long, in fact, that subverting them was actually the only method of getting housing at all. Anybody who waited their turn could be waiting years, if not decades, and virtually nobody got to the top of the list without some sort of subterfuge or ulterior methods. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, what this meant was that the informal distribution, that is, distribution that bypassed the formal bureaucratic system, was immensely important. There was a thriving second economy in the Soviet Union throughout the Stalin period. It had existed as long as the first economy and could in fact be regarded as a continuation of the private sector of the 1920s, despite the switch from barely tolerated legality to illegality. Like the NEP private sector, the Stalinist second economy essentially distributed goods produced and owned by the state, with privately produced goods in a distinctly secondary role. Goods leaked out of every state production and distribution unit at every stage, from the factory assembly line to the rural cooperative store. Anyone who worked at any level of the trade system was likely to be involved in some way, which meant that this type of employment, while bringing higher status than the average standard of living, was also seen as a shady and lacked social status. So this tells us some very interesting things about the economics and the sociology of Stalinism. That the black market was essential for living, that most, if not all, Soviet citizens on somewhere and some level, in some way, were involved in it. And the black market, what was distributed through it, was mainly the products of state-owned factories. So state-owned theft, theft from state-owned factories, was ubiquitous. It was widespread. So this must mean that most Soviet citizens understood that widespread theft from the state was embedded in nearly every aspect of everyday life. It was entirely possible that any item that was procured through any means other than queuing up for hours for it had dubious origins. And it must mean that most Soviet citizens tolerated, accepted, and even embraced as a means of survival the subverting of the Soviet economic system. So what that would suggest is that the view that there was widespread idealism in the Soviet system is probably fairly flawed. There were indeed people during the 1920s who believed that Stalinism would lead to the promised communist utopia and that the future was being built and that they had a participation in it. But alongside that, not only would they have known people who participated in the black market, but they themselves would have done so when needs must. Economists have pointed out that the Stalinist economy couldn't have functioned without the second economy. So without a black market, the system of Stalin's economic policy would have ground to a halt. Industry relied mainly on illegal procurement practices to get the right materials and equipment. If a factory producing goods in the Soviet Union needed next day delivery of machine tools or something else, these things had to be basically stolen from somewhere else within the Soviet economy. And the factory managers needed to have contacts in places where things could be loaded onto lorries, normally to keep themselves and their network of friends out of trouble and to meet targets. So there is an immense amount of chaos existing within Stalin's command economy and also within the five-year plans. Industries and factories employed vast armies of procurement agents or pushers, fixers, fencers, and thieves, in essence, to get hold of this kind of valuable equipment and raw materials. And so, because this is widespread throughout industry, it's widespread throughout the population. Buying food and clothing from black marketeers, or getting an apartment, getting railway tickets, getting passes for vacations at resorts, by blat, by influence, or by pull, as it was referred to, was an intrinsic part of everyday life. Some citizens relied on this more than others, and some are more adept at finding these sorts of fixes than others. The Soviet authorities applied the term speculation to any act of buying goods to resell at a higher price. And they treated it as a crime. In many ways, this was like the supreme crime. This was the crime of kind of petty capitalism, of exploitation of the workers, of trying to extract wealth from the proletariat. This is a Marxist perspective, though a kind of Marxist-Leninist perspective, though few non-Soviet Marxists have ever really given any thought to or any kind of critique of people buying and selling things. It seems to have been a particularly Russian variant of Marxist thought, and the obsession with speculation can be found, its origins can be found in the privations of the Civil War period and the tendency of famines to occur in Russia, meaning that state control of things, particularly like food resources, are a state obsession. So the speculators ranged from major criminal syndicates who were lucky enough to have lavish lifestyles, connections across many cities, and particularly connections with the parties, and all the way down to the poorest Soviet citizens who would barter and buy and sell small items of clothing or food in the morning, and then resell them in the evening, however many hours later, for a small profit. These were people whom, if they didn't participate in these kinds of activities, faced absolute destitution. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, a man named Zhidovetsky, sentenced to an 8-year prison term for speculation in 1935, bought up lengths of woolen cloth in Moscow and took them to Kiev for resale. Others, like Timofey Drobot, sentenced to 5 years for speculation in the Volga region in 1937, were former peasants uprooted by dekulakization, living a marginal hand-to-mouth existence. So these were people whose activities would be considered in any other society relatively mainstream and ordinary acts of commerce and economic self-care, self-preservation. The level of criminality, of actual gangsterism, among most of those who were sentenced to labour in the gulags, was virtually non-existent. One of the cases of speculation reported in the press, one of the biggest ones, involved a group of speculators who were described in the press as former kulaks and private traders, though the fact that they were described as that doesn't really tell you very much, as former kulak was kind of a blanket term for most things that are bad in Stalin's Russia. They set up a trade in bay leaves, soda, pepper, tea and coffee, using contacts in a series of cities across the Volga and the Ural Mountains, as well as Moscow and Leningrad. One of the men who was caught was carrying 70,000 rubles.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
At the time, and was said to have made a total of 1.5 million rubles for his operation. Najmuddin Shamsudinov, Magomet Magomadov, who were artisans from Dagestan, were, in Sheila Fitzpatrick's writing, not in the same league as the Bayleaf gang, but were caught with 18,000 rubles on them when they were arrested for disorderly conduct in a restaurant in the Chechen capital, Grozny, and they had just sent another 7,000 rubles home. The Bayleaf gang had obviously a very sophisticated operation that could not have existed realistically without party connections and without the kind of the connivance of the party. So on one level, the party and state are riven with corruption, which is kind of the product of Stalinist economics anyway. But at the same time, the Stalinist system was looking to merge together the notion of that which is criminal to that which is entrepreneurial or capitalist, and making no distinction between the two. And the Stalinist system was not just seeking to stamp out crime, but to really seeking to stamp out any notion of capitalist formation at all. Both Stalin and Khrushchev, and later in China, Mao as well, believed that the process of stamping capitalism out would take generations. They believed that capitalism was, you know, rather like economic weeds. Wherever you turn your back, it tends to spring up, and using ongoing and immense brutality, it could be torn out by the roots. There is an anecdotal story, I probably shared it with you before, of Khrushchev visiting Mao in the late 1950s. I think it was 1957. And the two of them driving through a part of rural China. And they saw, as a result of the growing famine crisis, a Chinese man begging by the road, selling the last of his remaining possessions for a bowl of rice. And Mao supposedly said to Khrushchev, though this is apocryphal, "See, there's your problem. It just keeps, you know, it just keeps springing up where you least expect it." And instead of seeing a starving man, Mao saw a capitalist, somebody selling his belongings for private gain. So, but that gives you an example of the kind of the extreme nature of ideology at this point in time, and indeed in the 1950s. The transport network in Russia is one of the means by which speculators, inverted commas, make it around. Provincial speculators would acquire goods and take them on train by taking the train to Moscow and Leningrad, where the stores are better supplied. They would then return to the regions and sell them at a profit. In Voronezh in 1936, 22 speculators were prosecuted, and they had all used this method. They had set up a dressmaking workshop as a cover for the goods which were obtained. So they were actually, in the same way that most European and most countries in the world now, drug money is laundered through everything from casinos to tanning salons. Here we have not money laundering, but almost goods laundering. so that you could provide an explanation as to why you had bolts of cloth or thread or what have you. And that shows you how the kind of economic system of Stalinism sort of inverted, in a way, the flaws of capitalism itself. It's interesting when you look at the Voronezh dressmaker's shop, what was found at the time. 1,677 metres of cloth and 44 dresses, but also two bicycles, many pairs of shoes, gramophone records. So what was being brought back from Leningrad and Moscow, it would appear, is not salt, sugar, fat, bread, these sorts of basics, but gramophone records. Now, this would suggest that there was an appetite for these sorts of things out in the provinces, that Soviet citizens were at a point in the 1930s where obviously there was a kind of a desperation for survival, for food and for housing, but people were still interested in enjoyment, in leisure, in the pursuit of kind of creativity and culture. And this could generally only be supplied through illegal means. The biggest operations had much more effective means of obtaining goods from state stores than simply going and purchasing them as ordinary customers. Big-time operators would have connections with store managers or warehouse personnel. Sometimes they themselves would be store managers or warehouse managers, and boxes would be put aside for certain purposes, be left at the back door. Store managers and other traders might also be involved, like, for example, the commercial director of a Leningrad clothing store, who was prosecuted for heading a ring of speculators that got its goods directly from the store warehouse. In the clothing store, the commercial director was not the only one involved in speculation. One of the salesmen and the head office store of the store's fire department were also involved and had made deals with other speculators to give advance warning when goods were coming into the store and to let them in without queuing, charging 40 or 50 rubles a time. So that seems to me to be the crucial factor. It was the scarcity of goods that creates the black market, that creates the gangsters and the speculators that need to have tip-offs to know when attractive goods are coming into the shop. And that that need to be able to do this in order to circumvent the problem of queuing. So nearly every job involved in trade or retail was seen as in some way suspicious, not just to the authorities, but to the public, who would have had a kind of a knowing nod that somebody working in a warehouse or somebody working on a shop floor or someone who was a store manager was probably taking backhanders from somewhere. A kind of a cynicism, but a cynicism that was also an acceptance that the most members of the public were the beneficiaries of this set in. And there was an acceptance by Soviet citizens that nearly every aspect of life in the Soviet Union was corrupted in some way. Some chose to believe that this was the residue of capitalist society, that several more generations of Stalinism would finally stamp all this out and the glorious future promised would emerge. Others, I think, were more circumspect and saw this as being an inherent part of human activity and something that even Stalinism wouldn't erase. Another role that was seen as synonymous with corruption was that of the train conductor. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "For example, a conductor on the Stalino Railway in the Donbass bought shoes and manufactured goods of various kinds in Moscow, Kiev and Kharkov and resold them along the run. Another conductor would pick up cloth in the provinces from people who were employed in textile factories. He also took trains to Shepetovka, which was close to the Russo-Polish frontier, and obtained goods which he smuggled across the border. Bathhouse personnel were also thought to be speculators, along with chauffeurs. And often small-scale speculators were often housewives who stood in line at the stores and bought up as many of the goods as they possibly could do, thus exacerbating the shortages. So they would try to wholesale as much cloth or linen or thread as they could get their hands on for resale later on. One housewife in Ostromova, who was described as a regular speculator in cloth, would buy 3 to 4 meters at a time. On her arrest, 400 meters were found stored in a trunk in her apartment. Apartments were of huge suspicion to the Bolsheviks and then to the Stalinists. These were venues where private life took place unaccounted for, unchecked, unfettered, and where subversive political thoughts might happen, and also subversive political and economic activities might happen. So they were often the venues for buying, for reselling goods. These often were not even stolen goods. These were just goods bought from the store, hoarded, and then sold on as a profit. Neighbours would know that a certain person, and it would often be a woman, would have a certain kind of item, a certain kind of good, and could acquire it or could drop in the evening to have a look at what she had. As with many in this what is referred to as the second economy, many of the transactions there, this is likely to be regarded in quite a different light by the participants, who saw it as friendship, and the state, which interpreted it as a crime. Other places that seemed to be synonymous with this kind of resale were railway stations and stores, and or where hawkers outside the store would sell the goods that had previously been bought within. Okay, well, I hope that you found that useful and interesting, and I will be continuing this little look at Stalinism throughout the next few months. Do remember, if you can, to swing by our Patreon page, and if you care to sponsor the Explaining History podcast, all contributions gratefully accepted. Till then, thanks very much, all the best, and bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.